Welcome back to Killer Fun, where we explore the intersection of crime and entertainment every other week. I'm Christy.
And I'm Jackie.
And we're so glad that you're back with us today. Today, we are talking about In the Dark. How do you solve a murder when you're blind? The same way anyone does, with tenacity.
She does have tenacity.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to take a guess and say that you liked this show.
I did. I did. A lot.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. And the reason I know that is because we're only talking about the first episode, boringly named Pilot, today.
But you sent like, give it a name.
Just give it some kind of name. Whatever. But you sent me a picture of your brand new puppy, who's adorable, and we may hear from at some point.
We may, because she's in my lap as we speak.
Uh-huh, exactly, because, you know, COVID's forcing us to once again do some virtual recording. Whatever, man.
But you know what? Even if we were in person, I think we would still have a puppy.
I mean, for real.
She's so young. She's only 9 weeks. And so she's like a little baby. So
Yep. She is a baby, but she's such a well-behaved baby.
She is a good baby.
So cute. And oh my goodness. Anyway, this isn't a podcast about your dog. This is about In the Dark. So you liked it.
I did. I really liked it. I did not know about that actress beforehand. I was not familiar with her. Mm-mm. And so not only is the whole show great and I'm totally enthralled and have continued to binge it, but I am a big fan of her now.
Yes.
I love her.
Yeah, she's not blind, but she does a pretty convincing job of behaving like she is.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah.
I mean, overall, like everything about her, I don't know. Like, I'm just a big fan. Like, I love her now. Like, why didn't I watch anything with her before? I don't know. I missed out. Well, she's just great.
Well, she started out her career. Well, let's just talk about the cast. Perry Mason plays, no, I'm sorry. Perry Matfield plays Murphy Mason. It's interesting, the actress and the character both have sort of androgynous names.
Oh, that's true, I guess. Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of interesting. Perry Matfield plays Murphy, and she started her career as a dancer. She's a ballet dancer, I believe. So she
you
did
can tell.
That. Yeah. Well, yeah, tall and willowy and gorgeous and moves very smoothly, even in a way that's convincing as somebody who doesn't move smoothly through the world.
Right. Yeah. There's an elegance to it, which is very interesting. The juxtaposition of her elegance and her character and all of that, how it fits together is just,
it works really good. Well. Mm-hmm. It works so well because her character wasn't blind at birth and didn't go blind as a young child. And I think that conveys it really well. Like there's a smoothness of somebody who used to be able to see the world, but now has a, I don't want to say jerkiness, but maybe lack of confidence of somebody who no longer does.
Right.
It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
She was in Shameless and the Wizards of Waverly Place, which my kids watched on occasion when they were little. So she looked familiar, but not super familiar. And I'm like, oh, well, that makes sense.
Yeah. I had never watched any of those. So I was unfamiliar.
Yeah. And then Rich Summer is Dean, the cop. He had a bit part in The Office, which is probably one of the things I recognize him from the most because I've watched The Office so many times.
So many times.
But the big thing he was in, he was Harry Crane in Mad Men. He was in over 90 episodes of Mad Men. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah. So that's really where he looks familiar. And I'm like, it's one of those, it's been long enough since I've seen Mad Men that I couldn't quite place him, but I knew I'd seen him in something. I've seen him in something really regular. What is it? We have Brooke Markham plays Jessie. She's been in several TV shows, but none that I've seen. She was a completely new face to me.
Me too.
Keston John was Darnell. And he was in several episodes of The Good Place, which is probably where I recognized him from. And he's going to be it's listed in the IMDb, all of the upcoming Avatar sequels.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
That's so big.
We'll probably be seeing a lot more of him relatively soon.
Mm-hmm.
Morgan Krantz plays Felix. He was in lots of TV, and what I recognized him from was a show called Switched at Birth that used to be on ABC Family.
Okay.
It was like 5 seasons long, and there's like 2 kids who are switched at birth, and they end up meeting one another, and it's how their families interact. The first like 4 seasons of it were really great, and the last season was terrible.
But
but it was a cute show, and he was in that.
I love his character.
Uh-huh. Yes. He's such a likable, unlikable person.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know Felix. How else to describe it. I mean,
no, he's annoying, but still kind of likable.
Yeah.
But you can see how he and Murphy might not get along.
Yeah. I want him to win, though, because he's putting in all the effort. He really yes. is. And so I want him to have big wins. And yet about the water cooler is about it. He was able to lift the new water in one of the episodes. He was able to replace the big water jug, and that was his like big triumphant moment, and I was happy for him. But that's you know,
exactly. Then we have Thamela Mumpumwana, who plays Tyson. He's had lots of small parts, but he's a pretty young actor, so he hasn't had a lot of time to have a whole lot of parts. But he did have a pretty significant part in voiceover work for the animated show Peg and Cat, which I think was on PBS. And it was one of those that my kids were just my youngest was aging out of that kind of show when that one started. But it's really cute.
Is it cute?
It's like one of those, you know how sometimes there would be the shows and you'd be like, oh, this is cute. I want to watch this one.
Yes. Like, it's I definitely had my preferences.
Uh-huh.
You
like,
know.
Peg and Cat, yes. Caillou, no.
No.
No. Then there's Derek Webster, who plays Murphy's dad, Hank. He's had lots of TV roles. NCIS, Star Trek, Ray Donovan, something called 911 Lone Star with Rob Lowe about firefighters, which I was like, wow.
Yeah, I know that. I don't know
Do
that.
You?
I know something about that that is not going to be helpful in this moment.
Okay.
Continue.
Okay. I guess it's set in Austin, so it's relative, like, geographically to us.
Oh, okay. That cued more information. Good. So I think I heard about it for the auditions.
Oh, okay. That would make sense.
It was a big deal here in the film community.
Well, then maybe it was filmed in Austin too.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. It was supposed to be filmed in Texas.
Cool.
So yeah, that's what that was.
Then we have Kathleen York plays Murphy's mom, Joy. She's had a really long career. She's a very familiar face.
Mm-hmm.
She started way back in 1984 with her career, which good for her. And she had a pretty great stint on The West Wing, which is probably her biggest thing. Then we have Callie Walton, who plays Chloe, Dean's daughter. And she is an actress. This is her big break. And she is actually blind. She's a little older than the character she plays in the show, but she thought she was going to have to give up her dream of being an actress. And then this show came along. She lost her vision like her senior year in high school. And the following year, she's 19. She played this, you know, 13, 14 year old in this show.
Oh, and she looks so young.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I know they do the makeup and I know they do all the things, but she really does.
Well, there's some things you can't fake.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And she does have a very young look about her, but I thought it was really cool. And then there's one more actor who got their big break in this show, and it's Levi, who plays Pretzel the dog.
Oh, I love Pretzel the dog.
Uh-huh. Yes. Very, very cute. I read an article about how the hardest part was suppressing Levi's natural happiness. He's just like the happiest dog ever. And they had to figure out how to suppress it enough so that he could be convincing as a guide dog. I'm like, it's like those stories you hear about dogs that are supposed to be wolves or threatening in some way. Mm-hmm. And they do such a good job acting, and they know they're doing a good job acting, and they're so happy they have to CGI out their wagging tails. It makes me so happy.
It's so, so happy. Cute. Mm-hmm.
All right, are we ready to recap?
All right, let's do it.
All right, Murphy is blind and reckless and selfish and fiercely tenacious. She, quote unquote, works at the guide dog organization that her parents founded and lives with her longtime friend, Jessie, who dotes on her. Every evening, spends time drinking at a local bar, having indiscriminate sex, and visiting with a very young and charming Tyson in the alleyway where he sells drugs. It's in this alleyway that Murphy finds Tyson's body, the same alley where Tyson saved Murphy from being beaten to death after being mugged. The police take too long to show up. The body is gone before they arrive, leading them to believe that the troubled girl is mistaken. Even Darnell, Tyson's cousin and boss, doesn't believe Murphy about Tyson's murder. Murphy dives into finding out what happened to her friend and finds more than she bargained for.
Nice.
So, reviews on this, pretty mixed.
You know what? I wondered if they would be kind of mixed.
Mm-hmm. Louisa Malore of Den of Geek thought the actors did a really good job. Good actors like these can only do so much with muddled, unsatisfying plots and thin characterizations. Okay. Rob Owen of the Pittsburgh Gazette says, it's welcome to see a blind person who's not a saint, which is also true. Yeah. Very often people with disabilities are a side character or somebody either perfect or really unimportant to the story in a lot of ways. So it is kind of nice. Joyce Slatton of Common Sense Media says, sex, booze, and smoking in an appealing but uneven dramedy. So
uneven.
Yeah.
That's an interesting term. Mm-hmm. That catches my attention.
Yeah.
Like, I want to know more about that. Like, why uneven?
Yeah. Well, I think the story kind of lurches a little bit in some places. It's not, but I mean, that's the way murder investigations, particularly those not being run by the police, generally happen.
Yeah. it's just such an interesting term. Like, it could apply to so many different aspects of the show, but it strikes me as being spot on.
Yeah.
But I also can't understand why.
Isn't that funny? Mark Perigard of the Boston Herald says he agrees with you about Perry Matfield. Mm-hmm. Matfield delivers a nuanced performance as a woman who has chosen to meet the world with hostility as a calculated defense. No matter how middling the story, she's always worth watching.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
That's super fair. All right. We're going to take a real quick break and we'll be right back with Is It True? Psychology Break and Real Life.
So here's how it works. Christy wrecks her search history. Hey, NSA, we promise it's nothing more nefarious than a podcast. To find out what's true, some of the psychological motivations behind the character's actions, and real-life applications that relate to our topic. I have no idea what Christy decided to look up. Could be the same thing that captured my curiosity or something I never thought of.
Is it true? So Murphy tells a man that she's with at the very beginning of the episode that her dog, which we later find out is her guide dog, is obsessed with her. And this is actually a real phenomenon. Velcro dog.
Velcro dog. Velcro dog.
Isn't that cute?
It's apropos. I mean.
Uh-huh. I mean, for real. And I guess if you're going to have a dog that's obsessed with you, having your guide dog be obsessed with you is probably pretty okay. Your guide dog wants to be with you all the time. That's good.
That is good. That is a good thing. But the episode is funny because it portrays the dog overseeing private moments very intently. And that can be a little unnerving.
Yeah. But see, it wouldn't really bother Murphy all that much because she
doesn't
see it happening anyway.
Right. Yes. That's true.
Dogs can become Velcro dogs for a number of reasons. Sometimes it's because we have our own behavior. So every time our dog comes up to us, they get pet or they get a treat or they start to learn that being right next to us means they get good things, things that they enjoy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, this is from puppyleaks.com, by the way, talking about Velcro dogs. If dogs have a physiological change, such as hearing or vision loss, that can cause them to become more clingy because it's scary. It's scary to have that change and you're familiar and safe. Then there's some dogs that are bred that way, that they're either bred to work alongside their owners or they were bred to be lap dogs. So they tend to be a little clingier. And then dogs such as German Shepherds and Akitas are very commonly attached to a single person most specifically, which I would say as I have a German Shepherd mix. True.
True.
She likes everybody, but she loves me. My dog. Oh, speaking of a menagerie, you have a cat.
Yes, and he's decided it's time to talk.
Yeah, that's all right.
And he might go around screaming.
That's all right.
He screams like all the time. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
it's a little.
If I didn't know better, I would think your cat was a little deaf.
I don't know what's wrong, but there's something about that. But he is a big cat. He's a Bengal. So he can be very soft when he meows or he can be very loud and like. So I think but he has a particular type of scream. And that's why we call him the rooster. Yeah, because it sounds like a daggum rooster is going about the house and wake up, get up. It's time to hang out.
Right. And then they go on to talk about how there's a little bit of a difference between a Velcro dog and a dog with separation anxiety. So a Velcro dog is just really wants to be close to you, but if you have to be separated, it's fine.
Okay.
And dogs with separation anxiety tend to have some panic.
Right.
When their owner is gone.
They have behavioral problems when their owner is gone.
Destroying things and different stuff like that.
Yeah.
So was it really Chicago? No.
It didn't look like Chicago.
No, it didn't. It like looked enough like Chicago to be like suspend your disbelief. But it's Toronto.
Okay.
Yeah. And Corey Kingsbury, who developed the show for the CW, said she thought they were going to get to shoot in Chicago. And that's part of the reason why she said it there was because she loved Chicago and wanted to spend time there. And then they ended up doing it in Toronto.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, this might sound very negative, but I felt like the storyline feels like Chicago.
Okay.
This feels like it's really there culturally, like all the things fit. Right. But it did seem disconnected. I don't know how to say this. The set was a little too elegant for Chicago.
That's
and I say that as somebody who doesn't live in Chicago, so don't at me about this. I mean, I'm just saying for the storyline and for what I was seeing, there just seems to be a disconnect between the elegance of certain things and what they were trying to portray as this very downtown urban life. And I don't know, maybe I'm completely off base. So if you at me, be nice about it. Be nice about it. Just correct me. Just, you know, enlighten me. But that's what it felt like. So when you say Toronto, I'm like, oh, definitely.
Yeah.
That's definitely that
city. It looks like Toronto. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
It does.
Yeah. So I couldn't find that there is a facility in Chicago that specializes in guide dog training. Because, I mean, I knew that Guiding Hope wasn't an actual facility,
right.
Wasn't an actual organization. But I was wondering if there was a guide dog training facility in Chicago. Not that I could find. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of service training dogs that might have guide dog training as part of it, but not specifically. But if you're in Chicago, there is an organization called Second Sense that has some helpful information about guide dogs and if they're right for you. And they work with people with vision loss and can help you get connected with an organization. There's only 12 guide dog schools in the United States that are accredited by the International Guide Dog Federation. So it's not really that unusual that Chicago might not have one, even though it's a large city. There's just not that many of them.
That surprises me. Mm-hmm. I'm legitimately surprised by that one because
I
would have thought there were so many more.
You would think that there's only 12 seems small. And I believe there is one in San Antonio.
Okay, so this begs a question. Uh-huh. This begs a question for me. I guess I always thought that if I were to go blind, my first thought would be like, give me a dog. Like, train my dog, right? I would, as a sighted person, kind of ignorantly assume that that would be first and foremost. Like, this has to happen. And I'm wondering now, based on that, the demand can't be that high. So maybe it seems like most people may not choose to have an animal.
I think it's actually a fairly small amount.
Interesting.
Of people. So this article from Second Sense talks about what you need to consider. So you have to be really committed to taking full responsibility for your dog's well-being. You have to be physically capable of walking. Mm-hmm. So you can't, if you're confined to a wheelchair, you can't have a guide dog. You would have a service dog.
Okay.
Because you have to be able to walk a mile. There's a lot of criteria that go into whether you're actually capable. And most of these guide dog organizations that I found all provide the dog and all of the training and travel to and from their facility for the person getting the dog. All of that's provided for free.
Wow.
So they're all nonprofit organizations, and they rely on donors to help cover that cost, which is large.
Yeah. Well, that's in keeping with the storyline of the show then, because you know, that's their whole nonprofit for providing guide dogs.
Right. Yeah. So I don't think it's the biggest way that most people with vision loss find to get around. There are plenty of people who have them, but there aren't a ton of people who are completely blind with no vision whatsoever. Most people have, there's different gradations of blindness. So you may, maybe somebody is technically legally blind, but they don't really qualify for a guide dog because they can see enough shapes and different things.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. Okay. Yeah.
We saw Murphy buying and taking Mondronix emergency contraceptive. Can you get that brand at your local pharmacy? No, you cannot.
Is that a real brand at all?
No, that is not a real brand. No. The most common actual names are Morning After, Plan B, New Day, My Way, My Choice, these kinds of emergency contraceptives. Though you shouldn't take it the way Murphy did.
No.
Because she just took it all the time willy-nilly and to try and not get pregnant instead of using other forms of birth control that would protect her also from STDs and things, or STIs. I'm sorry, that's STI is the current preferred nomenclature for that. So
yes,
but $34, very, very good price for her, because they're like $50.
Right, because at some point in the show, she mentions that it's expensive, and I'm thinking that didn't seem that expensive actually. But okay.
Well, I mean, if you figure, you learn later that this is a pretty regular activity for her. So, I mean, once a week at minimum, it seems.
It gets expensive when it's like that, but price per, not half bad. So.
Oh, yeah. I looked up the cost. And so I wreck my search history for all this stuff. Because I looked up how much it costs locally, and it's like $50.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not inexpensive.
No.
Do blind people touch faces to understand what a person looks like?
Okay. I'm going to say that I thought that was accurate.
Okay.
Am I right?
Yes, you are. So Murphy says she doesn't touch faces, and that is the most common reaction from people who are blind. So there is a great article on disabilitywisdom.com from a consultant named Dr. Ariel Silverman. And she says that you see it a lot in media, that people touching faces, blind people touching faces to quote unquote learn what somebody looks like. And that she says, in truth, I have yet to meet a blind person who habitually touches faces. This act is not only not socially sanctioned, but it usually provides little useful information.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not even it's really unhygienic.
Right.
For everybody, because the blind person has touched the face. You're touching the face of somebody. You don't know if they sneezed or it's gross. And that she said she's more likely to recognize somebody from their voice.
Okay.
Rather than touching a face, which would be weird to walk up to somebody you don't know and be like, hey, do I know you? Let me touch all over your face.
Kind of, right?
And she said, not really even by perfume either, mainly because people change that. They don't always wear the same one. And mostly she's going to get information that we would get from facial expressions or pauses. She's going to get that from vocal cues. If you're going to pause or the way you speak or if you hesitate, stuff like that. That gives her as much information as if you had, she could see your expression on your face.
That makes so much sense. And because that's true for everyone, we just don't typically pay attention to it. We typically rely on the visual body language.
Right.
And the expressions. But I actually find myself very interested in people's vocal tones and pauses and hesitancies. And maybe that's because I'm a musician. So I care about rhythm. And so I use very frou-frou terms sometimes with my band when they could be playing something right and it just sounds awful, you know, because there's just a certain energy. There's a lack of something to it. And usually it's something that's ridiculous. And if you walked in and heard me talking about it, you're like, you don't know music, but it's just beyond the page. It's beyond the actual division of the beat. It's the music of it. And so when I listen to people speak, I kind of hear that sometimes. I hear hesitancies and weird cues that just kind of hit me. Like, I hear what you said, but it didn't match how you said it. Mm-hmm. And it's subtle, not so much of a, preference, but it's just a subtle, like, something's interesting about that. Which probably causes more fights in my marriage than anything. Cause I'm like, oh, no. I don't believe you. You can say this and I'm saying, no, you're not. You're saying that, but you mean the opposite. Cause I'm hearing it. And sometimes you just got to know, you might be hearing it, but it's not about what they're saying.
Okay.
Right. Sometimes I might be hesitant because a different thought popped in my head. It makes me sound like I'm lying or like I'm not sure what I want to say. But it really sorry. Now the dog and cat are fighting. No, they had a little scuffle.
That's fine.
The cat walked up to the dog and was like, whap. Oh. Just out of nowhere. It tickles him.
Rotten. Yeah.
But yeah, it causes a lot of misunderstandings because when people have a hesitancy or maybe they sound like they're lying or they sound rushed, it could be because of something not related to you, And so,
right.
I think that's a thing for everybody, but I could imagine if I had lost my sight, how much more that would be confusing even.
Right. Yeah. That's interesting.
In some ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she also, Dr. Silverman wanted to remind people that if you're interacting with somebody in a professional capacity, and if you're like in a store and you're working with a blind person, you want to make sure that if you have like your badge that has your name on it, on your shirt, offer that information to the blind person.
Oh, yes.
I was like, okay. Oh, that's really smart. Hi, I'm Christy and I work for Walmart. Do you need some help locating something? like identify yourself as a employee and what your name is, you know, whatever, which I thought, oh, that's smart. And even, you know, if you were in an office setting, hi, I'm Christy and I work for XYZ company, you know, I'm so glad that you're here with us today. Identify yourself every time you see them so that they can get used to your voice or know who they're talking to.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So if I go to Chicago, can I visit the Lensmore? Nope. I have to go to Toronto to visit the Lensmore.
Oh, man. I thought this was going to be one of those, you know, oh, it's there, but it's really this restaurant and da, 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 da. But no, I guess they did film in Toronto. We did cover that. Yeah. I should have seen that one coming.
But like the name of the place is like, they didn't like change the name for the show. It is the Lensmore. They just like, it's not like when we talked about Fargo, where, you know, they changed the border crossing to the Lucky Penny.
Right. I think
that's right. That this, they're like, no, it's the Lensmore. We're not going to change the signage. We're not going to
rock
any of that. Yeah. I was like, oh, that's fine. So Murphy told the police that Tyson lived in Fuller Park. And yes, that is a real place in Chicago.
Okay.
It's the 37th of Chicago's 77 community areas. It is, unfortunately, identified as one of the worst areas in the city, which makes sense that Tyson might live there considering his occupation at such a young age. And it's also one of the smallest community areas in Chicago.
Well, I thought they did a really good job of setting up the story where, like I said, it did feel like Chicago. It felt like those areas. And I also thought they did a really good job of explaining the community and the process and the generational impacts and all of that on the story. It wasn't just people making decisions. It was people making decisions in a context, in a place, in a space, in a time. And I thought that was really good. I liked that.
What else could Tyson do
except
what he was doing?
And he was so super smart.
Yes.
Right. And, and that they made that clear. He's so smart. Why are you doing this? It's hard to grapple with, but what else was he going to do?
Right.
Yeah. It's hard.
Yeah. Yeah, it is hard. I mean, it's difficult to overlook the impact that where you live has on how you turn out.
Yes.
Because you can be super intelligent and some people leave those situations and some people are never able to despite their intelligence level.
Well, and it's about compassion. I mean, I don't think we get a lot of this in the first episode, but through the, you know, subsequent episodes, you do learn a little bit more about family and such. So I think sometimes when we think about people who don't get out of those situations, we're really being individualistic about them and what they want as if they don't have family they care for. Their decisions aren't about whether they can or can't get out of some place. It's about whether he's going to leave his mama.
Right.
What I mean, these decisions are made out of actually caring intentions for those around them to stay as part of their family and to contribute and maybe thinking that if they do that right for long enough, then they can put aside the illegal and the dangerous and kind of go straight later. And then they realize that's not an option.
Right. Once you're in, it's too late. Yeah.
And so that's just heartbreaking. But I mean, a lot of people don't get out of situations because they're choosing to stay and fight within them. And there's something to be said for that. That's brave. And it also just shows how weak we are as a, I'm going to just say it, as a nation. We just don't have the right programs to help people who want to do the right thing with their family and maybe do something in their lives that's more productive or at least not illegal or whatever. You know what I mean? I mean, we just don't have, we have programs to rescue out, not fix within.
Right. Yeah. And fix within is really, really key.
It's really key, but it takes a lot longer.
It does. It takes a lot longer and a lot more resources because that's saving everybody.
It's generational.
Yeah.
Like it's going to take 100 years to change certain places. It may take 20 years, 50 years to change others. You know, that's a long-term game. And we tend to like to give the short-term Band-Aids.
Well, I mean, when you save a kid, it's all very romantic and, you know, uplifting and very exciting, but it's a lot more work to save an entire community.
Yeah, a lot.
You know, I mean, oh, heartbreaking. So Murphy and Dean talk about Murphy's vision loss because Dean has a child who's blind. So Murphy's vision loss was caused by a real and rare disorder, retinitis pigmentosa.
Okay, so that was a real thing.
It is a real rare genetic disorder.
Wow.
So while it's rare, it doesn't seem that rare because it affects about 1 in 4,000 people both in the United States and worldwide, which doesn't seem super rare to me.
No, that's a prevalence but rate I wouldn't assign as rare.
Rare, no. But I think the idea that you would go completely blind from it is rare.
Okay, okay.
So it's an inherited disorder, and there is a lot of gradation within the severity of the illness. It typically appears in childhood, which we know is what happened for Murphy, and that some people retain like their central vision and just have an effect in their visual field.
Okay.
It depends on the person. It's different for pretty much everybody. But
so that's interesting that does it only affect the eyes? Like I know it's retinal something, mm-hmm. something, but oftentimes when you have a rare condition like that, it's related to some other things and you have other kind of symptoms and going on and signs in mm-hmm. the body and that right. only affects the eyes.
It seems that way. Yes.
Wow.
As far as I can tell. Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah. All of the sources that we use to inform our discussion here on Killer Fun Podcast can be found on our social media. Join us on Facebook at Killer Fun Podcast, exploring the intersection of crime and entertainment. You can find us on Twitter at Killer Fun Pod, or you can send us an email at killerfunpodcast@gmail.com, and I'd be happy to share a link to whatever information you're looking for. We love to hear from you. You might learn a little something too. Psychology break. All right. So Murphy has a pattern of self-destructive behavior, and she knows it to the extent that she tells her mother she doesn't care about herself at all. Which I thought, I'm like, boy, that's insightful for somebody, because her mom accuses her. So what's it like to not care about anybody but yourself? And she's like, I don't care about myself. Like,
it was a at great all. Moment.
It was so good. But I'm like, oh, that's really sad, though.
It's so hard. Okay, so I just was reading recently, and I have the book.
Uh-huh.
It's the 12 Rules for Life by Jordan Peterson. And this is a book I'm crawling through. It's the one where I go and, like, I read a chapter every month or so. Because I'm also devouring other books in the meantime. But he talks about this principle.
Oh, okay. Self-destructive behavior.
Well, yes. And this idea that we don't care about ourselves. And it is extremely insightful. And the title of chapter 2, or rule 2, I should say, is treat yourself like someone you are responsible for helping. And he talks about this very true trend that people are more likely to fulfill their pet's prescriptions and make sure their pets take all of them than they are to actually fill their own prescriptions and finish their own prescriptions.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's a very interesting thing that we go and he takes a long, deep dive into where this comes from and all the way back to Garden of Eden. So, I mean, it's not light reading this chapter, but it is true. We tend to care more about others than we do ourselves. Even our selfishness is actually a reflection of our self-hatred many, many times.
Aww.
Gosh, isn't that weird? Sad. I say weird. Like, I mean, it's a whole book's worth of discussion, this subject.
Aww.
I'm not self-destructive like she is, but I do feel what she's saying.
Yes. Well, amen, sister.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, because I'm way more likely to make sure that my husband or my kids or my dog gets the care that they need. Yep. Than I am. I'm like, I'll be fine. I've been fine always.
I'll be fine.
Up to this point.
You do the short term. It's kind of like with the Community thing. We do that to ourselves. Uh-huh. We give everybody else the long-term care, and we give ourselves the quick fixes and the Band-Aids, which often are the self-medication, the, you know, destructive behaviors, mm-hmm. because they're quick, they're easy, and whatever. The investment to truly transform, I don't think we think we're worthy of that. There are two reasons people don't set boundaries. Either we think they aren't worth the boundary, or we think we're not worth the boundary.
Oh.
Right? We don't think that we're worth somebody doing that boundary, AKA we're afraid they're going to leave. We're afraid they're, if we set a boundary, we're afraid they're going to cross it, and, or they're going to leave and they're going to say no, and it's going to be a pain. And what we think is we're just not worthy of that, of them sticking to it and doing the right thing. It's not really about fear. It's about, we don't think we're even worthy of them trying it. You know what I'm saying? And so there, it all speaks to this very internal existential crisis we are all in as human beings.
Wow. Yep. Wow. That's not where I expected that conversation to go.
Yeah, that wasn't encouraging at all,
boy,
was it?
You just like, just fire that arrow right at me. Go ahead.
This is what, I mean, I know. That was not a fun or encouraging, but it was killer.
Oh. Hey.
Okay, let me put down the 12 rules for life. This is not something we want to keep talking about right now.
Yeah, no, put it over there. It's happy over there on the bookshelf. It cannot make me cry over there on the bookshelf.
So what else you got?
Well, we all have self-destructive behaviors, and it's easy to see some of the most indicative ones in Murphy's behavior. Mm-hmm. So impulsive and risky sexual behavior, overusing drugs and alcohol, alienating or aggressive behavior that pushes people away, avoidance, procrastination, passive aggressiveness. And a risk factor can be for self-destructive behavior is both a symptom of and a potential risk factor is drug and alcohol abuse.
Right.
So you can be self-destructive because you use alcohol, or you can use alcohol as a self-destructive behavior. Hello, cat eat, or snake eating its tail.
Yes.
Cats don't eat their tails, but snakes do.
Oh, you know, my cat kind of does, which really speaks to the whole situation we had earlier with him and the dog. Okay. No, that's so true. And that's why with psychology is so hard, because we don't have this factor. We can't put the things in categories and just deduce a diagnosis. Uh-huh. We have things that serve both as diagnoses and as symptoms, as triggers and as results. It's very difficult to parse that all out.
It's not like algebra where you can just solve for X.
Well, it's not even like medicine, the rest of medicine.
Okay.
I'm very much a fan of saying there is no mental health and medical. There's just health.
Health. Yeah.
There's health. And so therefore it's all medical. But the way that we approach medical situations as we know it today with the physical body really does lend itself more so to the way that they diagnose now with, you know, using factors and putting things in categories, you know, I come in and I say, hey, my face hurts and I got postnasal drip and I have a headache and I have malaise, and the doctor's going to go, oh, you have a sinus infection. Like, I'm going to take all these symptoms in these signs that you have. And then I'm going to say, you know, boop de boop equals this, right?
Right.
Mental health doesn't work that way, because you can have factors that go in multiple places. So that's why they're divided. But on the other hand, I don't want to divide them. It's all
right.
It's all health. And so it's,
yeah.
Shout out to the people who have to think about that.
Yeah, yes. Well, and another thing that can be a risk factor that Murphy had in her life was childhood trauma, neglect, or abandonment. We know she spent some time in the foster care system. And social isolation and exclusion, which is common among the visually impaired. This article also mentions that self-destructive behavior can be a coping mechanism, even if you didn't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, yeah, that's it. It's, you cope with things by using the drugs. by drinking the alcohol. Oh, so sad. So what can you do if you see a loved one engaging in self-destructive behavior? And okay, so this article from WebMD by Leslie Becker Phillips, who's PhD. It borders a little on something I don't like very much, but she says, you love the person but reject their behaviors, which sounds a little bit like love the sinner, hate the sin.
Yeah, it does.
But it kind of is, I can see where she's coming from with this, that it's you detach from them in a little way where you're, so you can be unaffected by their self-destructive behavior. You still love the person, but try and not be affected by their behavior to the extent that it makes you also, either their behavior is destructive to you or that you also engage in self-destructive behavior.
Right.
Yeah. And that's basically the only help that she had.
It's so sad. We want to think that there's some way to just go in and rescue. And, you know, there might be little things, loved ones, certain people in close proximity. Like in the show, Jess has more proximity to Murph as her best friend and roommate and has more of an opportunity to speak truth into her life and try to give her opportunities to grow and tell her when she's being out of control, or literally rescue her from something, you know, take care of her. But at the end of the day, Murph has to decide to participate in her own healing.
Yes. I mean, really, that's the long and short of it.
And how, I guess the question for us all is, we can't go in there and rescue. We also need to protect ourselves because it's not healthy for anyone if we all get sucked into the vortex. But how do we live our lives around those people so that we might pose an invitation for them to get better?
Okay.
You know, like when we walk away, do we walk away with a kindness and a loving that leaves it as an invitation? You know, this is boundaries. How do we set boundaries well so that others may thrive?
Yeah.
You know, because boundaries.
Yeah, you don't want to enable.
You don't want to enable.
If you don't set the boundaries, you're enabling them.
Right. But if you walk away hard and be like, forget that, it's abandonment.
Right, exactly.
You know, and so some, and you know what, I have to say this, some people are not in your circle enough. The boundary situation is different. Like there are people in your orbit that's a little further out, and you're going to have to just walk away, and there's not much you can do to pose an invitation. You're not going to be able to like do a lot because they're just not that close to you. And so you're, and it kind of might feel like, boy, that's just not being a kind person, but really they're just not in your orbit and you just have to accept that and move on. Or you might have to make the harder choice to say, no, you can't come in closer orbit.
Yeah.
And that's hard too. But it what I'm talking about with the boundaries, like the abandonment versus enabling, that's for like loved ones who are very, very close, you know?
Right. Right. Know, yes.
Those are hard things to deal with.
All right. And then there was one more thing that I wanted to talk about. So Murphy meets Tyson's cousin and boss, Darnell, in a diner. And even though it's not a date, Darnell tries to order for her. So this is a really big red flag. Medium.com has this whole article. Women, watch out for this ominous sign at your dinner date. It can be argued that men who choose what their dates eat and drink without first asking them what they prefer play into a wider gender power imbalance in dating. In the cases of some men, it can even be a sign of more dangerous behavior.
Ooh, yikes.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was pretty ubiquitous, right? Like, I mean,
well, I mean, he asked her if she liked pancakes or flapjacks. I don't remember what he called them. But, and she said yes. She answered affirmatively, but doesn't ask her if that's what she wants.
Right.
He just like orders for her. And so it kind of indicates that he has, there's a power imbalance of some kind.
Yes.
And yes. And that he thinks that he can just order for her and she puts him in his place.
Yeah.
She's like, yeah, she tells the waitress, no, that's not what I want.
Yeah.
Thank you, but no, I don't want that.
So, she did awesome. I thought she did.
Yeah, I thought she did really, really well. But this article says that controlling what a woman eats implies a desire for dominion over a woman's body.
And you know what? That power dynamic, I see that to be true in many circumstances, because it can mm-hmm. happen in business too. You go yeah. out to a business lunch and the person who thinks they're the one in charge orders for the table. And mm-hmm. I'm not talking about like an appetizer to share.
Right.
Like they just place the orders for whatever. And it does. It makes them feel like the big boss and or yeah. the big guy or the one who's important. And so I could see that to be true across.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So even though this particular article is talking about it in a romantic sort of mm-hmm. way and how that it can be an issue, even though it may seem chivalrous, it's really not. That really, it can happen in any sort of relationship. And this right. was Murphy saying, no, you don't have power over me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was good. That's cool.
Yeah. All right. So real life. Murphy tells one of the police officers that her senses aren't heightened because of her blindness. And really, that's true. It's their senses aren't heightened, but they do tend to pay more attention to the senses that they have.
Okay. So I was there with that. When she said that, my first thought was no, they just pay more attention to it.
Uh-huh.
And so, yes, yeah. I was good. Yeah. I was on board with that.
You are absolutely right. That said, the brain structure for people who are born blind or lose vision before they're 3 years old is at least sometimes different.
Mm.
So like they've done MRIs looking at people who are sighted normally, they have mm-hmm. regular vision, you know, within the spectrum of regular vision, and people who went blind in early childhood or were born that way. And they did find a combined structural, functional, and anatomical changes in a brain that are evident in people born with blindness that are not present in the brains of sighted persons.
That's very interesting.
So it's just, the plasticity of the brain.
Right. Just develops differently right. because of the different sensory inputs.
Right. Exactly. Well, like there's the, I'm sure you've seen the article they've done on the boy who he was born. No, he went blind at a young age. He had cancer.
Okay.
And he uses clicks, like okay. echo. He uses echolocation, and it's incredible. Like he can walk down the street and not look like he's blind, other than the fact that, like, I think he does not have eyes because that was a big thunder. Sorry.
Yeah, it was.
He walks down the street, doesn't look like he's blind at all because I don't think he has eyes actually. So that's a little bit different, but he'll just walk down the street, click, click, click.
Okay.
And he can like tell where he is and what's near him. And they've like taken him into different facilities like laboratories and things and put different shaped objects in front of him. And he can like walk around it and click and tell you how tall it is and what shape it is. And he's like, I think this is an edge here and this is an edge here. So I think, or this doesn't seem to have an edge. This seems round. It's incredible.
That's radical.
Yeah.
I mean, amazing. Okay, there was a Criminal Minds episode where the killer used clicks because the little boy used clicks as a blind kid.
Oh,
so it's interesting. I'm like, maybe they kind of based it off like this dude, except it was much more violent. The kid mm-hmm. used the clicks and then the killer learned the clicks.
Oh,
it was a whole okay. thing. But I hope it would be a whole thing because it was a whole episode. So anyway, I digress. But it's interesting because when you started telling that story, I thought about that episode and I thought, oh, wow. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that can even be taught. It has to be something innate.
Yeah.
I just feel like it does.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and he came up with it on his own. So it made sense to him.
Oh, okay.
And I mean, it was pretty incredible. Like he could walk down the street and tell you, there's a pole there. I think that's a bush. That sounds like a trash can to me. Oh, wait, is there something on the ground here? Oh, there's a bike laid down on the grass.
Oh my gosh. That's
like,
crazy.
It was incredible. Like so amazing. So he may have a little bit different of a brain structure.
Mm-hmm.
So Murphy and Dean's daughter, Chloe, kind of talk about being loners.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of people who suffer from depression are also loners, and that depression is quite a bit more prevalent among the visually impaired. Unfortunately, the visually impaired individuals, it is a risk factor for depression. And they did a study and found that 29% of the patients with visual impairment suffered from pretty debilitating depression.
I don't doubt it.
No. And it varies, though. The more independence the blind person has, the more they're able to rely on themselves, the better off they are. The more they're forced to depend on other people, either because of their living situation or where they live or their degree of blindness, mm-hmm. the more they're dependent on other people, the more severe their depression is.
I could imagine. Watching anything that talks about disability, especially concerning the senses, right, makes me think a lot. And so, you know, I would never want to lose any of my senses, right? Nobody wants to. Mm-mm. But if I had to lose one, like if I had to go deaf or I had to go blind, right? If I had to experience one of those two conditions, I have to admit that even as a musician,
I think hearing.
Yeah. Right? I'd want to be able to see. And then I realized, I tried to rationalize it with all these nice thoughts first, you know, like, you know, for instance, you know, I just want to be able to navigate the world a little easier. And I feel like I can do that visually better than I can, like all these kind of rationalize. And then it came down to one thing. I am too vain.
I want to be able to see to put on the fake eyelashes.
Yeah. I would feel so crippling insecurity come over me about how I look. Uh-huh. I couldn't control it. I couldn't control my image to the world. OMG, I would literally give up being able to sing and play music for real. Like all of that just to make sure I don't look like a fool going around. And I'm like, oh gosh, that just brought up some ugly I got to deal with, you know? And I'm looking at her and I'm like, well, if I was going to be blind, I sure hope I would look like her.
Oh, I know. Tall perfect. And willowy and gorgeous. And
perfect long hair that just falls. And I mean, she just looks gorgeous no matter how bad she feels. I mean,
yeah, no makeup, doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
Because so, she's perfect skin. And
even a hot mess, she just still looks great. And I'm like, I would not be that elegant hot mess.
I'd just be tripping over stuff. It'd be sad. Gosh.
Okay, but while we're on the subject, can I bring up something other than, well, in keeping with vanity, but...
Sure.
But not? Okay, anyways, the young girl, the kid, what was her name again?
Chloe,
thank you. Okay, mm-hmm. So she has a scar or a...
Right.
It looks like a scar because it's very wide for even a barber's cut. Like, right. Like even like a line, it looks wider than a line.
The reason that they gave for her blindness was that she was in a car accident.
Right. So I assumed that this was a scar. And she has the gems... Yes. On the scar. And I
loved it so much.
Genius. Because you and I have a mutual friend who has a scar very similar. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I almost texted her a picture. Like, you have to do this. Uh-huh. This is so cute.
Yes. Yeah, it's adorable. Cool. Like, way to take something that could cause you to feel self-conscious about yourself and say, here it is. And it's beautiful.
And it's beautiful. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like, I want to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Like, yeah. I want to have jewels in my hair.
I do. Well, you know, we don't talk about it much, but I do have a hair disorder. So, you know, I wear lots of hair pieces and stuff to cover. Right. Because I don't really have good hair. You know, the disorder comes and goes and it's been better. It's been worse, whatever. But, you know, there are times where I just wish I didn't have to do so much work with it. But seeing what she did with that was very inspiring.
Oh, good.
It was very inspiring. I might get radical soon, y'all.
You know what? I hope so. I've been telling you for a long time that I love it and I don't care what's going on under there. I love you and I think you're beautiful no matter what.
Oh, you're sweet. Thank you.
Anyway, all right. Now that love fest is over, let's talk about how Hank Murphy's dad never forced Murphy to say, I love you. Mm-hmm. In fact, she told him only 3 times in 20 years, and he told her, that's enough.
Yeah.
And I'm like, sweet. What a great dad.
And that's why she has a good relationship with him and not her mother.
Right. Well, I think she and her mother have clashing personalities. They're a little too much alike, and it's a whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're a disaster.
Yeah. But scarymommy.com has an article, Why I Don't Force My Kids to Give Hugs or Say I Love You. I want my kids to understand consent. Willingly giving someone a hug or a high five is much different than taking one, even if the hug is not coming from a malicious place.
Yep. Agreed.
Yep. Yep. And she goes on to say, I don't tell my children or anyone else I love you in order to hear the words repeated back to me. It's nice to hear, especially when you can hear the love coming from someone's voice. Mm-hmm. But love should not have strings attached and should not need to be validated. Not giving or reciprocating affection is not rude, ungrateful, disrespectful, or entitled. And I think that's a hard lesson that we're learning now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, growing up, I know it was expected of me to say things and accept hugs or give hugs. And, you know, it's a difficult transition especially for grandparents and things.
Yes, it's a generational difference. It's definitely cultural, but it's also very American because our greetings that we have the handshake, but that became, okay, I'm going to opine. That became such a business thing that I think that it lost what it might have been personally. But it is a very cold way. And yet there's something about, like, for instance, bowing that has a intimacy to it, even among acquaintances, you know, or other ways. But I think in America, the hug, certain the greetings and whatever, it's going to fall by the wayside. Even in Europe, they're talking about the kiss is fading away.
Yeah.
That and even that could be a little less intrusive than a hug, you know.
Well, can I tell you, I'm a little sad about that because one of the jobs I had many years ago, we had a number of people that would come from Europe to come here for training and different things. And I loved it when they would like lean in and do the double kiss. And
yeah.
It felt so like warm and loving. And I can get now, I'm that kind of person. I'm a touchy feely. I love to, you know, hug my friends and things like that. And I know not everybody is like that, but it spoke to me in a way that, and it was always so non-romantic, which was great. It was also so nice to have that not be intimidating because it was sexual in any way. And it wasn't
right. Cause it's not handsy. You know, like I would prefer that. I don't mind the double kiss or the single kiss. We live in San Antonio. So more influenced by the Mexican and the Hispanic and Latina culture. So the single kiss, but I mean, I would prefer that.
It's more like touching cheeks and making a kiss sound.
That's right.
It's not really kissing, but still in COVID days, maybe don't.
And maybe don't. And that's fine. But the hug and the intimacy that we have, like in America, there seemed to be no balance. You either was like cold as ice or because the handshake also is a power dynamic. Who has the better handshake and whatever. Yeah. It's a competition. And then or the hug, which is so intimate, wrapped around, trapping. And some people, it's a little that's the moment where it can get creepy. The hands can do a slow fade off or they could be a little tight, you know, and juggling that has been hard. I mean, we've invented the side hug, which is equally awkward and weird. So, I mean, I don't know.
Yes, I understand that. CreativeHealthyFamily.com has an article and they have a quote from Irene Vanderzand, who's the co-founder of Kid Power, Teen Power, Full Power International, forcing children to submit to unwanted affection in order to not offend a relative or hurt a friend's feelings. We teach them that their bodies do not really belong to them because they have to push aside their own feelings of what feels right to them. This can lead to children getting sexually abused, teen girls submitting to sexual behavior so he'll like me, and kids enduring bullying because everyone is having fun.
That's right.
And I'm like, that's it. That's
period.
Where we've got to empower our children to say, to accept the hug or be able to refuse it and respect that boundary that they've set for themselves.
Exactly. They are worth the boundary.
Yes, for sure. Joy, Murphy's mom, still attends parents of special needs support groups, even though Murphy is in her 20s and hasn't lived with them for seems quite some time. Mm-hmm. I don't think she's like in her early 20s either, because Jess is a full-fledged veterinarian and that takes quite a lot of schooling.
Yeah. Agree. Yeah.
But there are actually, I hadn't thought of this. There are a lot of different kinds of support groups for parents mm-hmm. with children of special needs. And so there's like the emotional support groups where you can talk about how difficult it is sometimes to have and care for mm-hmm. and love your children who have special needs. There's, you know, financial worries, different things like that, that can be really helpful to have a group who focused on that. Then you have your school-based groups. So mm-hmm. you have common people with a common interest to fight for their children within the school system that might be a particular group. Then you might only have available to you regional groups. So you just, these are the people that are near you. So you have a group that you talk to.
Right.
There are national groups that can help with these things. So like the Easter Seals or the ARC mm-hmm. are national organizations that might have local chapters that can offer services to both parents and children. And they are a little more able to support for the service organizations that would be around you. So if you need help finding services or schools or housing or even employment for your child, these are the kinds mm-hmm. of groups that would help you. And then if you have a specific need, an online group might be helpful. So, you know, if you have a child with a specific disorder, you might get together with a group online and talk mm-hmm. about that specific disorder. If you're a parent of a special needs child and you're going through a divorce or particular educational methods that you think would be helpful or being employed, those are the kinds of things you might also want to talk about online with people so that you can get the most sympathetic group who can really understand what it is that you're trying to accomplish.
And this is where social media can be helpful. I mean, you know, Facebook has done a good job with groups, creating groups, allowing groups to exist. And, you know, there's issues. There's always going to be issues, but you can usually find a group for almost any intersection of issues you have. There's only one group that's missing. And my son identified that recently. He would like to join a I Hate Andy Warhol group because he has a special disdain for that type of art, of pop art that Andy Warhol does. He can't stand it. He has a ridiculously impassioned response to this for a kid who really doesn't care about art overall, but I digress. And so I made the comment that there's probably a group for that. There's not.
Really?
Yeah. So somebody out there needs to start a I Hate Pop Art group. Which doesn't support anybody, but it'd be fun.
Right. Well, exactly. Well, see, and that makes sense to me that particular child would not care for pop art. And I love pop art. I think it's awesome. I love seeing the art in like a soup can.
I mean, I thought Andy Warhol was always very insightful. I don't know that it's the type of art that I would want in my home, but I love it when I see it out mm-hmm. in other situations. Oh, yeah.
Andy Warhol exhibit at the museum? Absolutely.
Sign he saw me an up. Advertisement. I'd like to go look at it. He saw an advertisement and was like, just by the way, I'm not going to that. Impassioned response about Andy Warhol.
Wow. Well, he can stay home and play with a puppy.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. So next time we're going to talk about imposters, some deception as the name indicates, and I think it's going to be fun. There's more than one season of it, so it did well enough to get a second season, which is always a good sign.
It's always a good sign. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be really good. So
yeah, me too. And until next time, be safe, be kind, and wash your hands. Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum. Da, 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 da.